May it please the court.
Good morning.
William Brownell, on behalf of the state of Mississippi, the NAAQS Coalition, and other industry petitioners. Your Honor, Section 109D directs EPA periodically to review and to revise existing ambient standards, here the 1997 ozone standard. In 1997, EPA explained that risk estimates played a significant role in revising the ozone standard to provide the requisite degree of public health protection, reflecting the Clean Air Science Advisory Committee's advice that the assessment of risk must play a central role in revising the ozone standard given the lack of bright-line health thresholds. In 2008, EPA said again, we're revising the ozone standard based on the science and the risk assessment, but then said the risk levels it found requisite in 1997 are no longer relevant. It said this for two principal reasons. First, that it is not legally required to consider the requisite risk levels on which the 1997 standard was based. And second, new studies have made it more certain about risks below 0.08 ppm, the existing standard level, but not 0.075 ppm. Regarding the first point, this is a proceeding to revise an existing standard, not a de novo proceeding. The existing standard and the risk estimates on which it is based are the starting point under Section 109D for assessing whether revision of that existing standard is appropriate. Otherwise, one cannot know whether risks are now higher or lower or the same as those that were requisite in 1997.
But that question assumes, at least as I understand it, that there's some sort of inertia behind the existing standard. That's not my understanding of what EPA is supposed to do, right? Aren't they supposed to be revisiting things all the time as new technology allows new measuring? What's the significance of the fact that we're starting with the standard and trying to decide whether we should move from there?
The significance, Your Honor, is that EPA's discretion is not unbounded. They're bounded by the limits of the requisite standard, sufficient but not more than necessary under Whitman, and by the bounds of reasoned decision-making. And if in the prior standard setting they have determined certain levels of risk are requisite, sufficient but not more than necessary.
Can't they revisit that based on new evidence?
Absolutely, Your Honor, they can revisit that. But they need to take that important aspect of the matter, the risk determinations, judgments, and the underlying risk estimates from 1997 into account in revisiting it.
Well, they did. EPA explained that it looked at those risk assessments and explained that they weren't adequate to the task this time and that it wanted a more qualitative judgment, right? I mean, they're not locked into, simply because they used a certain kind of risk assessment in 1997 doesn't require them to use the same technique today, does it?
Well, in fact, Your Honor, they did not. They say in their briefs and they said in the final decision that those risk estimates were irrelevant because the methodology that they're adopting now for the standard doesn't allow for consideration of those prior risk assessments.
They have a more qualitative approach. Yeah, I understand, but my point is that the agency did take account of risk this time. It just did it differently than last time, right? You're not arguing they didn't account for risk. Your point, as I understand it from your brief, is that they used quantitative risk assessments last time and they need to use the same kind again, and the agency found that wasn't necessary and that there were reasons for not doing that. Isn't that right?
The point from our brief, Your Honor, is that they need to take into account the risk judgments they made before. All they have said now is that we're more certain that the principal consideration petitioners ignore and our approach to looking at what we did before is to do a qualitative weighting, and the principal consideration petitioners ignore is our views on certainty and uncertainty.
We're more certain now. Did you start with this point because this is your strongest argument?
Your Honor, we believe we have two strong arguments here. One, that the agency has ignored the requisite standard of Whitman, sufficient but not more than necessary, and in determining whether risk is not more than necessary, they need to pay attention to what they determined before about the risks that are requisite. And the second point, in conjunction with that first point, that's at the very least an important aspect of the matter that the agency needs to consider as a matter of reasoned decision making. And I think the related and second point, Your Honor, is that mere recitation of certainty and uncertainty is not sufficient to satisfy the Whitman requisite standard.
That's
essentially
true. That's definitely true.
What we have here, Your Honor, is that the agency is saying that more studies mean more certainty, mean more protection, but uncertainty remains, which means either more protection to address the uncertain and the unknown, or less protection because things are just too speculative.
What is EPA to do with, given that argument, what is EPA to do with Kasich's recommendation? Kasich said, Kasich recommended unanimously 0.06 to 0.07 and said that was supported by overwhelming scientific evidence. So, well, I mean, how does that relate to your argument about uncertainty?
Your Honor, it relates to the argument because Kasich's role here, whatever Kasich says, it doesn't displace the agency's authority to make a risk policy judgment or the agency's responsibility of considering all significant aspects of the matter. And I think when you look at what the agency said about risk now and in 1997, it illustrates why it is important to consider those 1997 judgments as an important aspect of the matter. In both 1997 and 2008, there were two categories of risk assessment. Risk assessment looking at lung function effects based on clinical studies, and risk assessment looking based on epidemiological studies, looking at respiratory symptoms, hospital admissions for asthmatics, and the whole pyramid of effects that the agency refers to. Regarding the lung function effects, the 2008 assessment, and they did risk assessment in 2008 as well, looked at the same three studies for the 1997 assessment plus the ADAMS studies. And the record shows that the ADAMS studies have a lower dose-response relationship than the studies that were the basis for the 1997 assessment. That is, at any given exposure level, risks are lower. How does lower risk undermine the 1997 requisite risk determination? Well, we don't know because the agency declined to undertake the comparison. In 2008, a whole category of risk was eliminated with respect to respiratory symptoms because, as the staff explains, studies since 1997 found no respiratory symptoms in outdoor children. So they were eliminated as a category in the risk assessment. With respect to epidemiological studies, the 2008 assessment was based on the same study as the 1997 assessment, Thurston, 1992. Staff recognizes that that does not result in a change in risk. In fact, the staff says the principal difference between the risk assessments was lowering the background assumption from 0.04 ppm to 0.015 ppm, which adds the most uncertain risks of all.
Could we just go back to, as I understand what the agency did here, it gave three reasons for not making the comparison you are arguing for, right? Your point is they failed to take account of the 97 risk assessments, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. They gave three reasons in the final order for not doing that. One is they said the quantitative risk assessments in 97 were not the only basis for the agency's decision then. Right? That was one of the reasons.
That's not correct. They said the 2008 risk assessment was not the only basis, but right. In 1997 and 2008, they said the 1997 risk estimates were a significant role, played a significant role in that decision.
They didn't say this time around that one of the reasons they weren't making the comparison was that the risk assessments in 97 were not the only basis for the agency's judgment about risk?
Your Honor, as I understand
that, is that inaccurate, decision, what I just said? I mean, I was just reading from the agency here, so that was one of the reasons.
They say that the 2008 assessment was not the focus. Uh-huh. They explain in their brief the 2008 assessment was not the focus for their decision this time around. In fact, if one looks at Joint Appendix, pages 38 and 46 of the 2008 decision, they recognized in the 2008 decision that risk assessment played a significant role, risk estimates played a significant role in the decision to revise the standard in 1997 to provide the requisite degree of protection.
Correct. Right. But all right. Well, let's go on to the second reason. The second reason they said was that that the quantitative assessments were inadequate to capture certain qualitative judgments that the agency thought was necessary. So the comparison, you know, they were comparing apples and oranges because the quantitative risk assessments didn't produce the, richer risk assessment that the agency wanted. That was the second reason, right?
And I have two comments on that, Your Honor. The first is that in both 1997 and 2008, EPA said the epidemiological evidence is indicative of a broader pyramid of effects that we are taking into account in exercising our risk judgments. That broader pyramid of effects included hospital admissions, emergency room visits, and so on. The agency was making both quantitative and based on the quantitative qualitative judgments in 1997 and 2008. And at the end of the day in 1997, the agency said, based on all of this evidence, risk, exposure, and so on, we are weighing the importance of increased protection for extremely sensitive individuals, including asthmatics, in judging the 0.08 ppm standard requisite to protect public health. These 1997 risk judgments and the risk estimates on which they are based are relevant to defining the lower bound of the agency's authority under the Whitman requisite standard, because recall that standard is sufficient but not more than necessary. And having concluded that a level of risk reflects the level that's sufficient but not more than necessary in 1997, that's at the very least something that needs to be addressed now. The second point on that, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
No, my second point on that is escaping me right now.
Okay, well, you can think about it. Let me ask you about their third reason. The third reason they gave was that, the agency gave, was that the 97 estimates reflected outdated analysis that's been updated this time. And so again, the agency, I guess, thought it wasn't appropriate to compare quantitative assessments that were based on evidence that has now been updated to make it more accurate.
Thank you, Your
Honor.
What's
your reaction to that?
It brings back the other point I was going to make.
All right.
My answer to that is that, yeah, sure, there are differences in the risk assessments in 1997 and 2008, but those differences do not make the earlier risk assessment and risk estimates irrelevant. Rather, those differences are what need to be examined to determine whether there is any change in the risk judgments and underlying risk estimates that led the agency to conclude that the 0.08 ppm standard was sufficient but not more than necessary. I've run through some of those, Your Honor, that, you know, the risk assessment of lung function effects based on clinical studies did include new clinical studies, but if one were to do the comparison, those clinical studies showed a lower dose response relationship. One can look at respiratory symptoms. Sure, there were differences, but a whole category of risks was eliminated in 2008 because newer studies show no symptoms in outdoor children. Epidemiological-based risk assessment for excess hospital admissions and the entire pyramid of effects, sure, things differed. The background assumption changed from 0.04 ppm to 0.015 ppm, but that added highly uncertain risks because, as we know, EPA says risks become increasingly uncertain and unreliable as one goes below 0.08 ppm, and these risks that were added between 0.04 and 0.015 are the most uncertain and unreliable of all.
But you seem to be arguing almost for a presumptive validity to these earlier NACs, so that it's something that EPA has to overcome before they can do something different. But if that's the case, what is the point of, you know, building in this review process?
Your Honor, the review process still plays an important role. My point is that the agency needs to take into account its prior judgments regarding the Whitman sufficient but not more than necessary standard. Otherwise, that standard becomes wholly subjective. without any consistent or principled or predictable meaning.
I want to understand what your argument is, and it seems to me that if you're saying the point of the review is that the agency can basically take into account new information, more up-to-date information, and that seems to be what they're doing here. So I guess what I want to understand is how should they have done it differently? You keep saying that they kind of ignored these earlier things. Is it just that they should have said magic words that we did look at this and now we've moved on? Or is there something specific and substantive that they needed to do?
No, Your Honor, and I think it goes back to the differences between the risk estimates and risk assessment in 2008 and 1997 that were not taken into account because the agency said we do not have to look back to what we've concluded about risks in our prior review. It's at least an important aspect of the matter that needs to be considered to inform their current risk judgments. If this is a proceeding...
So they couldn't say, for instance, that we just now think this approach, for example, is outdated. You're saying they would have to somehow incorporate those earlier NACs into their new assessment.
Or at least explain. My point is, Honor, that Your Honor, that they should be required to explain why differences from the risk judgment that they arrived at earlier in concluding that this level of risk is sufficient but not more than necessary justifies a new decision that points to a different risk level. For example, if the 1997...
You don't dispute that at 0.080 there were significant adverse health effects, do you?
I dispute that,
you
Your Honor, because if one looks at the record where the adverse effect come from are the clinical studies, which in both 1997 and 2008 show transitory, reversible, small effects down to 0.08 ppm. Your Honor, if I can just follow up, the new information on that since 1997 are the ADAMS studies.
Well, excuse me, did you say in response to Judge Griffith that there's no evidence of adverse health effects at 0.08? Is that what you said?
That's what he said.
No. I said there are the same small, reversible, transient lung function effects that we looked at in 1997, that the agency looked at in 1997, based on the clinical data, and that the only new clinical data are the ADAMS studies, which the author, of course, concluded showed no statistically significant effect below 0.08.
Well, but the agency,
EPA reanalyzed,
the agency with Kasich's support, reevaluated the ADAMS study and looked at it differently.
Your Honor, EPA did reanalyze,
right.
And this is another issue here. They reanalyzed, confirmed ADAMS result for one of the studies. For the other study, found a small statistically significant effect at 0.06 p.m. Right. of 2.7% lung function decrement, which is consistent with what the staff characterizes as normal lung function variability of 3%. Further, EPA pointed to what it characterizes as two notable individuals that had higher responses in the 10 to 15% range. Mm-hmm. But there were also outliers in the very extensive 1997 clinical studies, and those outliers in some cases were higher than the outliers in ADAMS. At the end of the day, EPA says the results of ADAMS is so very limited, it cannot be generalized to the U.S. population. And of course, the ADAMS study showed a lower dose response relationship. So getting back to Judge Brown's question, these are basic comparisons that need to be done, should have been done, and would have been done if the agency was required to explain why its risk judgment is changing from 1987.
How are we supposed to think about the margin of safety here? I mean, didn't Congress acknowledge that there's a fair amount of imprecision in any of this and gives to the administrator discretion to build in margin of safety? How does that fit into your argument?
In this way, Your Honor, again, the margin of safety standard is not unbounded. Whitman addressed the language, requisite to protect public health with a margin of safety, sufficient but not more than necessary. The agency exercised its discretion in 1997 to conclude at a certain risk level that standard was met. And bringing that margin of safety concept into this review, at the very least, it's an important aspect of the matter that they need to consider in explaining why more margin of safety, why a different requisite judgment is necessary now.
Well, maybe the answer is that there's the agency believes the science is more solid now than it was then, calls for a lower NAC, which would therefore call for a different margin of safety. I mean, for example, let's assume they thought that the Adams study was far more dispositive than they thought it was, and that 0.06 was appropriate, then there would be a new margin of safety to take account of the uncertainties surrounding that, right? I mean, the margin of safety that was adopted in 97 isn't, or is it your position that margin of safety is sufficiently broad and precise to cover today's uncertainties? Is that your point?
That is my point, Your Honor, first of all, right. And second of all, that at the very least, because the agency concluded in 1997 that there was a margin of safety in a standard that it set to protect against even sensitive individuals.
That was based on 1997 science.
It
now the agency has 2008 science, which obviously, at least from its perspective, has reduced the uncertainties at certain levels. And so, I mean, do you have any case that says that any authority for the proposition that the margin of safety having been set once in 97 is their guidepost for 12 years later?
What I have, Your Honor, is the American Farm Bureau case where when the agency set the annual standard in the subsequent review, they adopted a methodology which did not look at the 24-hour studies on which it had based the annual standard the last time around. The court said that's an important aspect of the matter from the prior review that needs to be looked at now in exercising the agency's judgment. Just like here, 1997 risk judgments, which were comprehensive based on an extensive scientific database, if the agency had done the comparison of the science, as we've explained in the brief and I've tried to explain this morning, it would have found that there is little different from a risk perspective.
I thought that maybe we're talking about different aspects of American Farm Bureau, but weren't you referring to the part of the decision where the court criticized EPA for departing from Kasich's recommendations about the 24-hour study? Wasn't that? Or are you looking at a different part of the case?
I was looking at a different part of the case, Your Honor, where you criticized the agency for having adopted a new methodology that ignored part of the rationale for the prior standard, which it was revising in that case. Uh-huh. Your Honor, I see my time has expired unless the court has further questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, David Barron for American Lung Association et al. I'd like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal. The Clean Air Act requires that health standards for pollutants like ozone be strong enough to assure the absence of adverse effects in sensitive groups like children, asthmatics, and people with respiratory diseases. The record here contains an extraordinary body of evidence that EPA's 2008 ozone standard fails that test, evidence that, as Judge Tatel indicated, Kasich found overwhelming. There are chamber studies showing adverse effects like constricted and painful breathing at 0.060 part per million, far below the 0.075 standard adopted here. numerous epidemiological studies showing statistically significant hospitalizations, emergency room visits, breathing harms, and other harms at levels well below 0.075. Toxicological studies showing how ozone can cause these harms, and risk assessments predicting that in just the few cities studied, 340,000 children would suffer adverse breathing harms under a standard of 0.075. This compelling mass of evidence led a unanimous CASAC and the nation's leading medical societies, including the AMA, the Thoracic Society, the College of Chest Physicians, and the Academy of Pediatrics, all to conclude that 0.075 was not protective of health and a much stronger standard was warranted. Now, EPA doesn't dispute this compelling mass of evidence. In fact, EPA relied on much of the same evidence in deciding that the prior standard wasn't strong enough. EPA's main rationale for rejecting stronger protection here is a nebulous claim of increasing uncertainty as to ozone's role in causing adverse effects at the lower levels. But that claim can't be squared with EPA staff's own finding that ozone at 0.060 parts per million is, quote, likely to cause adverse effects in sensitive groups, close quote, like children, asthmatics, and others, a finding that the staff repeated three times and that the EPA administrator never directly disputed. Moreover, a vague claim of increased or more uncertainty is just not a reasoned basis for allowing all these adverse effects to continue, because it doesn't say anything about whether the uncertainty is great enough to really matter. If all EPA has to do is say that there's more uncertainty at one level than another, then the agency can disregard even...
Let me ask you, I think one of your strongest points is the disagreement with CASAC, or this unanimous CASAC. But how are we supposed to think about that when the administrator goes separate ways from CASAC? I mean, we have an example of that in American Farm Bureau. But can you help me understand how I'm supposed to think about it when I see the administrator disagree with CASAC? I mean, is there a presumption that attaches to CASAC's recommendations? I mean, legally, how am I supposed to think about
what happened? This court has held that EPA must either follow CASAC's recommendation or come up with an explanation.
Right. And they've done that here. They've come up with an explanation here. How are we to weigh those?
Well,
I mean, they didn't do here what the problem was in American Farm Bureau, where it just didn't seem to be much of an answer. They tried to give an answer here. But how are we supposed to think about it when they give an answer? How are we supposed to weigh it? We're not scientists, right?
Well, particularly where you have a unanimous CASAC recommendation, I think the level of explanation that EPA has to provide.
Where do you get that from? Is there law on that, or?
It's just the under basic principles of
it. Because if it's a dispute between scientists, we stay out of that, right? I mean, lots of case law that says we're not scientists, we're not experts. Our job is to look for a minimal acceptable level of rationality by the EPA. When we have CASAC saying one thing and the administrator saying another, how are we supposed to view that? Yes, they have a disagreement. So what?
Well, part of determining rationality is whether the explanation matches real-world evidence and real-world judgments made by experts. And if you have literally every expert, every medical organization and all of CASAC saying that this is not a rational approach, then that moves the bar somewhat higher for EPA to explain why their decision is nonetheless a rational one. And I'm not saying, of course, EPA, you're correct, Judge Griffith, EPA is entitled to deference on judgments, but those judgments have to be bounded by the statute, by principles of reasoned decision making, and by the facts. And it's not just the CASAC recommendation here, but the evidence that they based it on the broad range of epidemiological, chamber, toxicological, and other evidence, which EPA just didn't confront here. All they gave us as an explanation for rejecting all of these studies and all of this evidence was that there's some nebulous amount of more uncertainty at lower levels. And as I was saying, that's not a reasoned explanation. If that's enough, then EPA can disregard even probable harms to people just because they're more probable.
You don't disagree that where there is uncertainty, they get to exercise rational judgment, right? I mean, lots of cases we have that say that. When they are in the realm of scientific uncertainty, there's going to be heavy deference that we pay to their decision.
I didn't hear the last part. Heavy
deference. We're going to give great deference to EPA when we're dealing in an area of scientific uncertainty, right?
Well, I don't know about heavy deference, but the agency is entitled to deference provided it provides a reasoned explanation that's consistent with the statute and the facts.
I thought we were talking about uncertainty. You're disputing their characterization of the evidence as uncertain here, right?
Well,
and the game here, right, the real game here is between 0.060 and 0.080, right? I mean,
0.075, actually. Yeah.
Well, no, that's where they said it, but I'm saying the debate is whether there's uncertainty between 0.060 and 0.080, right? Or where's the debate? Where's the uncertainty? What's the range in which we're in uncertainty?
That's part of the problem here, Your Honor. EPA never said at what point the evidence becomes too uncertain to credit these adverse effects. All they said is that at some point this happened, but they don't say where. And the court has no basis here then to judge what level is too uncertain. And getting back to your earlier point, Judge.
I thought your point was that just to stick with CASAC for a minute, that the uncertainty here is where between 06 and 07, right? Isn't that your point? That there's uncertainty as to where it would be set, but there was no uncertainty. I thought your point from your brief was there was no uncertainty at above 0.07, right, based on the science? Isn't that your point?
Well, Your Honor, we think there's powerful evidence all the way down to 0.060, and I think that was made clear in our brief. But certainly at 0.070, even EPA indicated earlier that its concerns about uncertainty seemed to be focused below that, and then later they said the concerns were focused below 0.060. But in any event, this court has said, and I want to get back to Judge Griffith's question, that on these particular kinds of decisions where people's lives are in the balance, EPA has the heaviest obligation to explain every step of its reasoning. And they just didn't do that here. It's just to say it's more uncertain at one level than another, all that means is that even if you have a very probable adverse effect at a particular level, EPA can disregard that because it's even more probable at some higher level. It's just not a reasoned explanation for decision. Now, EPA's uncertainty rationale also irrationally assumes, and it's not very well explained, it's not really explained at all, but to the extent we can discern anything at all here, they seem to be assuming that only the chamber studies at 0.080 and above show that ozone causes harm. And that not only completely disregards the Adams chamber studies, which did show harm at 0.060, but EPA's own findings that the epidemiological studies, of which there were more than 200 since the last review, also showed, when read together with the chamber studies and the other evidence, the toxicological studies, that ozone causes hospitalizations, emergency room visits, and other adverse effects that are caused at levels below 0.080. So this whole notion that EPA seems to be operating under, that the only real proof of ozone causing harm is at 0.080, is just not supported by the agency's own findings. Finally, I'd like to turn very briefly to margin of safety, because even if you assume that there's some uncertainty here, EPA gave us no explanation at all, none, about how its standard provides a margin of safety, which the statute requires for the precise purpose of protecting against uncertain harms. Now, the lawyers, EPA's lawyers, say that EPA accounted for the margin of safety throughout the process. But EPA itself never made that claim, and it's belied by the agency's choices at every key juncture, almost every key juncture, to opt for less protection rather than more protection. EPA.
So is your argument that EPA here simply failed to explain why they were doing what they were doing, or is your argument that given what's in this record, they could not have reached a reasoned decision to set the level where they did?
Well, it's more the former, Your Honor. I mean, they are required, as I said, to give a very rigorous explanation here, and they just didn't do that.
Let me just follow up on Judge Brown's question. I was about to ask a similar question. Let's assume you're right. Let's assume that we agree with you that there's a problem here. I want to ask you about the remedy, and I think Judge Brown's question sort of highlights the point. Nobody wants us to vacate this, or at least you don't, right?
No, we're not asking for vacature.
So what do? We remand it with what is your point that are you looking for us to say now that there's no science that supports 0.075, or are you asking us to simply say to the agency there's a failure of a rational explanation here? And then what do we do about time?
Well, I think it's a combination, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. The failure to explain is partly, the failure to explain rationale is partly informed by this mass of evidence. And as in Farm Bureau, in the Farm Bureau case, the court noted the evidence which looked very strong that the standard was not adequately protective, and that called for an explanation that the agency didn't give.
Well, you need to help us with this remedy question. Do you think the agency, I hear what you're saying when you answered Judge Brown's question, that you want us to say the agency now that whatever it does when it reconsiders this, 0.075 is off the table, right? Is that your point?
Could you repeat the last part of that, Judge?
Yeah. Sorry. Is that better?
Yes, thank you.
Yeah. The question is, when we send this, if we send this back, are you looking for this court to rule that 0.075 is off the table, that that's no longer an option? In other words, that the agency cannot, under any circumstances, come up with a rational explanation for that? Is that your position? Or are you asking us to simply send it back with a direction that they justify their departure from Kasich and fill in the other gaps you see in the record?
Well, Your Honor, obviously we'd be delighted if the court held that 0.075 isn't strong enough, because the science clearly doesn't support that. But at the very least, we'd like the court to hold that given the evidence in the record, there's no rational basis provided for a standard that high. And you know, this court typically does not take the position of telling EPA what standard to set, but frankly, we don't see, and the record doesn't seem to provide any basis for a standard that high. And so I think that,
what do we do about timing? As I understand that the agency, EPA, is going to produce, is going to reconsider this in, what is the schedule? In 2014, they'll have a revised NAC. Is that right?
They're now saying the end of 2014.
End of 2014. So, I mean, what do you want us to do? What do you want a time frame? You say in your briefs you want a time frame, right? Imposed on the agency. Is that right?
That's correct. That was in the New York brief, and we fully confer with that.
And but now EDF, where we did that, there was also a violation of a court order, whereas there isn't here. So, I mean, what do you want? I mean, is Mr. Meyer going to answer this question? You need to help us on this remedy, if there is to be one, in terms of timing, because, I mean, if we send this back to the agency, to EPA. So it's going to be simultaneously redoing this NAC, the 0.075 NAC, while it's producing a new revised one under the statutory schedule for 2014, right? I mean, how's that going to work? I don't understand what's going to happen if you get what you want here.
Well, I can address that, but Mr. Myers was going to, so
right, well,
if you'd be okay
you
with
him
that.
Note if you want. That's okay. You're out of time anyway.
I am out of time.
Okay, fine.
Unless.
So let's hear from Mr. Meyer.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Your Honors. Michael Myers from the State of New York, New York Attorney General's Office, on behalf of New York, 11 other states, and two cities. Judge Tatel, I will begin with the question that you just asked of Co-Counselor Barron. We believe that, well, it's our position that the standard of 0.075 cannot be sustained based on this record, and therefore should be remanded back to EPA with instructions that it come up with a standard that does comply with the statute. What we're also saying is, at minimum, a remand for further explanation is required, because even assuming a 0.075 standard could be justified based on this record, the agency has failed to articulate how that standard will adequately protect public health here, especially with respect to sensitive populations. In terms of the remedy, how would it work? As Your Honor points out, and as EPA said in its brief, it is in the process of undergoing its regular five-year review for the NACs. What we think, there are a couple of different options here, Your Honor. One would be to remand to the agency with a expedited deadline so that they would have to come back fairly quickly with a standard based on this record. And we know that they have already gone through the process of taking a relook, a reconsideration at this standard already. So we think that should be something that they could do in relatively expedited fashion, certainly well in advance of when they would have to come out with a, or when they're planning to come out with a new NACs in 2014. I think
wouldn't it have to do another proposed rulemaking? Wouldn't it have to go through the notice and comment process?
Well, I'm not sure, Your Honor. I think it may depend to a certain extent, you know, what this court says in its decision and whether or not in the reconsideration it's already undertaken in terms of notice and comment, it's already addressed those issues. But I would also say that, you know, if this court sets a deadline, then EPA has the option certainly of expediting its current NACs review. If it chooses to try and combine the two, which it says it would like to do, it would have that option to try and expedite the process in order to move things along so that it would be doing both at the same time. So I think those are the two basic options, Your Honor, in terms of remedy here. This court held in the American Farm Bureau case that EPA has an obligation to explain how a primary standard not just protects healthy individuals, but also protects those who are more sensitive to pollution. And requiring the agency to show its work is not just some academic exercise. As this court explained in American Lung Association, EPA has the heaviest of obligations to explain and expose every step of its reasoning because lives literally hang in the balance. Now here, EPA concluded that, the administrator concluded that important new evidence showed that people with asthma, and that includes 11% of adults in this country and 13% of children are in that group, asthmatics suffer greater harm and are more likely to suffer harm at lower levels than healthy individuals. Yet when it set the standard at 0.075, it cited the need to make that standard be below 0.080, which is the standard the administrator said he had a high degree of certainty that healthy individuals suffer harm. But given his conclusion that people with asthma are likely to suffer greater harm than healthy individuals and suffer harm at lower levels, he failed to, at 0.080, in other words, he failed to explain how a standard set barely below 0.80 provides that adequate margin of safety to those who he concluded suffer harm at lower levels. This court's decision in American Farm Bureau is therefore directly on point. There, the court remanded to EPA for further explanation a standard, a primary standard that the agency had based primarily on protecting healthy adults from premature death, yet failed to explain how that standard also provided an adequate margin of safety against children and other at-risk groups from respiratory illness, given the evidence in the record that they would suffer harm at or below those levels. EPA has asked the court to allow it to make a similar leap in logic here. I see my time is just about expired. One thing I did want to note is that in terms of the 0.070 part per million standard that the administrator decided not to adopt, in the preamble to the proposed rule, he looked at that number as an important surrogate measure for potentially more serious health effects in at-risk groups, such as people with asthma. Yet, when he set the final standard, he just deemed 0.075 to be sufficient. That decision should be remanded.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Madeline Fleischer. I represent respondent, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. I will be addressing the primary standard today, and my colleague, Mr. Kaplan, who's with me at council's table, will be addressing the secondary standard and any questions on remedy as well. If I can, I'd like to start with the industry arguments in order to explain that the significantly expanded body of evidence since 1997 clearly showed adverse health effects in healthy individuals at levels down to 0.080 parts per million, and therefore did require the administrator to revise the 1997 standard, which was effectively 0.084 parts per million. Then I'd like to move on to the environmental and state petitioners' arguments, as to which I have three main points. First, there were uncertainties remaining below 0.080 parts per million based on the evidence available in 2008, as reflected in the fact that both CASAC and the staff paper supported standards in the range above 0.060 parts per million. Adams did not resolve all uncertainty in this case, and therefore the administrator exercised his judgment. My second point is that he exercised his judgment based on an explanation of how he weighed the available evidence, including Adams. And finally, I'd like to discuss that in weighing the uncertainties below 0.080, the administrator did both protect at-risk individuals and provide a margin of safety by setting a standard appreciably below 0.080 parts per million, which was the level at which there was a high degree of certainty about adverse health effects. Turning to industry's arguments, they essentially argue that the evidence is the same now as it was in 1997, and therefore no revision was warranted. That's simply not true. There was additional epidemiological evidence, which, among other things, importantly showed, as it had not in 1997, that there were effects, adverse health effects, including serious adverse health effects, associated with ozone at levels even in areas meeting the 1997 standard or in considering only subsets of days below the 1997 standard. There was additionally new clinical evidence providing biological plausibility for the epidemiological evidence in the form of clinical evidence showing that asthmatics are more sensitive to ozone than healthy individuals. The industry's focus on the risk assessment really misses the full picture of that body of evidence. As the administrator explained, both in this rulemaking and in 1997, the risk assessment can't capture the full pyramid of effects necessarily as to which there is a body of evidence associating ozone with adverse health effects. Therefore, the administrator reasonably explained that the primary focus in 2008 was on the full body of evidence and the adverse health effects it showed being caused by ozone at levels below the 1997 standard. In deciding to revise the 1997 standard, the administrator did not simply provide increased protection. Rather, he also considered factors such as the relevant uncertainties, the size and nature of the health impacts, and he did conclude that impacts down to 0.075 parts per million would be important from a public health perspective, thus satisfying his obligation to set a requisite health standard. Finally, if I may, I'd just briefly like to address industry's arguments that in describing the body of evidence, the administrator somehow did so in a biased, not objective, or not accurate way. I think it's first just important to note here that the two sources they cite, the EPA's non-binding Information Quality Act guidelines, as well as Section 108's directive to prepare a criteria document that accurately reflects the latest scientific information, don't add anything to the standard of review here, which is simply whether the administrator has reasonably explained his decision. Here he did so. He did accurately describe both the strengths and weaknesses of the available evidence, but once he had done so, he was free to draw his own conclusions about the import of that evidence for the requisite level of an ozone standard. Moving on to the environmental and state petitioners' arguments, I think it's revealing here that they're talking about what the science requires. As this court has acknowledged, none of us are scientists. So the question is,
CASAC? I mean, the Congress put CASAC in there to be an honest broker, right? I mean, they have experts from different fields, and here you have unanimously them saying that these standards are inadequate.
So 2 points on that, Your Honor. First, just briefly, it's clear from the statute that CASAC's EPA's obligation with respect to CASAC's obligation with respect to CASAC's recommendation is to explain if it departs from that explanation. It doesn't have any binding effect on the administrator. And second, I think that what CASAC actually recommended is revealing. They did not say that the standard has to be 0.060. They recognized uncertainty.
No, but they said the science unanimously supports a range of 0.06 to 0.07.
I think that the nuances of that recommendation.
What's nuanced about that? They said, quote, the overwhelming evidence supports 0.06 to 0.07. That's not a nuanced statement. And it was unanimous.
Oh, I think that does implicitly recognize that there is uncertainty down to 0.060, otherwise a 0.070.
Correct.
But not above 0.070.
Or above 0.070.
Yeah.
Well, that gets to what the administrator's obligation here, which is he explained why he saw the science differently.
Would you agree that if the administrator misstated CASAC's findings, that that would be a failure of rational explanation?
I think if he misstated them in a material way.
Okay, well, let's talk about that, okay? So, and you correct me if I'm wrong about this, but I saw EPA giving a couple of reasons for departing from CASAC. One was that that CASAC's decision seemed to be a mixture of science and policy, right? That was one of the reasons.
I don't think that was, I would say there were two main reasons.
I said there were three, and I just started with the first one. You agree that's one of them, right? No?
I mean, I would focus more on the actual discussion of the evidence with respect to Adams and as well as the risk assessment.
All right, but humor me for a minute. I saw in there, I was quoting, quote, mixture of science and policy comes from the decision, right? Joint Appendix 149.
Certainly.
That's one of the reasons, okay? So, I understand the point that if CASAC's decision is based on policy, obviously the administrator is the ultimate policymaker here. But as Judge Griffith said, CASAC was put in there to set a scientific standard from which the agency has to operate. And I don't see any policy underlying CASAC's recommendation between 0.06 and 0.07. I don't see, can you point to anything in either of their letters that suggests that range, that there was any policy above 0.07? In other words, the 0.06, as I read CASAC, its recommendation was that the 0.06 to 0.07 range is based on science. And obviously, where you would set it within that range would be a policy judgment. But I don't see anything that suggests that CASAC was relying on its policy judgment in recommending that range.
Again, two points here, I think. First, I think it can be a little bit difficult to pick that out because CASAC's recommendation is phrased in fairly general terms.
What was general about it?
I mean, in that they don't, I think you're looking for where science leaves off and policy begins, and I don't think they necessarily describe that.
They quote, ozone panel members were unanimous that the level should be lowered from 0.08 to no greater than 0.07. In addition to EPA's own findings, in the final ozone standard paper, overwhelming scientific evidence for this recommendation. I don't see anything subtle or nuanced about that. I don't see that that was in any way based on a policy judgment. And my question to you is, was it? Can you point to anything in CASAC that suggests that when CASAC came up with that recommended range, it was somehow relying on its own policy judgment as opposed to its assessment of the scientific record? That's the question.
Certainly. I would say that the fact that CASAC is recommending a range shows that science does not dictate any one particular standard. So
within the range.
It has to involve policy as to what's the requisite standard.
Where? Show me in the CASAC letter where they said that. I quoted you the sentence about overwhelming scientific evidence. That's all I could find. Did you see anything in there that suggested they relied on something other than their assessment of the overwhelming scientific evidence?
I unfortunately do not have the letters right in front of me. I will say that I think that the translation of the science to a requisite level requires, as this court has recognized, a gauging of the public health effects of a pollutant. And as soon as you have uncertainty regarding effects, policy is introduced as to how you're going to weigh those effects.
This court said several times, and the Supreme Court has said, that you can't just sort of wave uncertainty over something and that then frees the agency to ignore the science. True, uncertainty, if it's explained, is certainly a legitimate factor to say. But we've said several times that, you just, you know, they can't waive that word and, you know, abracadabra, they're free to, you know, decide to disregard the science. They have to be far more precise. Let me ask you about the second point. They also said, EPA also said, quote, there's no bright line, clearly directing the choice of level, right?
Yes, I believe that's
okay. All right, but again, and this relates to my first question, Kasich did see a bright line. The bright line for Kasich was 0.07.
I think that I have to sort of cabin EPA's statement about no bright line. I believe that simply pertains to the fact that since there's no threshold known for ozone, there's not going to be a bright line threshold that points out a particular level.
Excuse me, Kasich's recommendation is to the contrary. Kasich says there is a bright line, 0.07.
I think Kasich would certainly disagree that there's a threshold level for ozone effects.
I know you're changing you're not answering. I totally agree with you about that. But this is a threshold pollutant. It's a non-threshold pollutant. But in their recommendation to the agency here for setting the NAAQ is that there is a bright line, and it's 0.07. Am I misreading this?
I agree with you that they said that the overwhelming scientific evidence supports that. At the same time, Congress said in the Clean Air Act that recommendation is not binding on EPA. EPA is allowed to disagree on the science.
Absolutely.
Is allowed to disagree on policy.
But under the statute, they have to explain their basis for disagreement.
Certainly, I'm happy.
And you agreed with me that misstating Kasich's findings would be a failure. In other words, they can't misstate it and satisfy their obligations under it. They have to state it accurately, and then they can explain in rational terms why they're departing from it, as long as it isn't just uncertainty. Right?
Well, I guess this is where I would say I think it's important that it be a material misstatement. I think here the question...
You don't think either of these we've been talking about are material?
I think the characterization of whether an assessment is a policy assessment or a science assessment was not central to the administrator's
decision. Isn't it fundamental to under the statute, the agency has to explain its departure from Kasich. And whether Kasich's recommendation is scientifically based or policy based seems to me would dictate the way in which the agency can explain a departure from it, correct? If it's a scientific decision, then doesn't it make sense that the agency's explanation for why it's departing from it would be a scientific one, namely, look, they would say Kasich recommended X based on science. We've looked at the science, and here are the three reasons why we think the science doesn't support that result. That would be a rational explanation. Now, if it's a policy judgment, right, then obviously the agency has far more flexibility when it comes to policy. But it's hard for me to understand why you think this statement is not material for those reasons. I just don't get that.
I can tell you that I think it's material. I'd refer the court to Lead Industries Association here, where the court talked about the difference between a policy question and a science question, but recognized that in both cases, the administrator's obligation is simply to explain his reasoning. And he did so here.
Just trying to understand your point. Is your point that the Kasich's recommended range itself is a policy judgment, that it's not just purely science, but that itself is a policy judgment? So the statement is accurate then?
I guess I'm trying to avoid pronouncing on whether it's a science or policy judgment.
Well,
apologize.
I think it's pretty significant. I mean, because Judge Tatel's right? If this is a policy judgment, then there's a lot more latitude that EPA has to disagree with them on policy. If it's a scientific judgment, then EPA has to, I think there's a higher burden for EPA to explain why it's ignoring the science or disagreeing with the science. So what I'm trying to get at is and you may have said it and I just didn't catch it. Are you saying that the range that Kasich is recommending, that the establishment of that range itself is somehow a policy judgment? When they say that it's got to be between, you know, 0.06 and 0.07, that that conclusion itself is laden with policy.
I would say that in this case, where KSAC's recommendation of a range conceded that there was uncertainty
within that
within the science, that led them to recommend a range, then yes, policy, however KSAC described it, I do think that when you have uncertainty, it's the administrator's, in part, policy.
What's the basis for the uncertainty of the when you go above 0.07? What would you say is the uncertainty there?
I would say it's the same as the reason for the uncertainty when you go above 0.06. It's that, we can talk about the evidence available below where the administrator said there was a high degree of confidence, which is 0.080. Below that, you have basically, I would say, three sets of evidence. You have the epidemiological evidence, you have the evidence regarding greater sensitivity in asthmatics, and you have the Adams evidence. With respect to each of those, I think it's in the record that the administrator explained how he weighed those and why he found there to be uncertainties both below and above 0.070. Before I address that, I do want to take a second to address what I think can be a little bit of confusion that seeps in about the fact that the standard was set at 0.075, just so we know what numbers we're talking about. The administrator chose that standard based on a finding from the exposure assessment that a standard of 0.075 would substantially reduce or eliminate exposures down to 0.070. So 0.070 was where he had his primary focus on in terms of the requisite level of protection. I do think that is important to note, given the fact that that's where the KSAC recommendation ends.
Let's stick with KSAC. You wanted to say at an earlier point a few minutes ago, you wanted to talk about the Adams study, right?
Certainly.
Do you want to do that now? Because I think that relates to, I told you I saw three areas that concerned me, and this was one of them. I'll just tell you exactly what my concern is. One of the reasons that the agency gave for departing from KSAC here was that he said he put different weights, right?
Correct.
Different weights onto different types of evidence, and one of which was the Adams study, correct?
Yes.
Okay, right. What I see here as I read KSAC is they said that the Adams study, they referred to it as a backup for the findings of the epidemiological studies, a backup. KSAC went on to review the epidemiological studies. It called them a broad range of epidemiological studies. And then it concluded that, it said we conclude each of these findings, and it's talking there about epidemiological and Adams, each of these findings to be an important indicator of adverse health effects. So, I don't. Again, maybe you can explain to me why the administrator's statement that KSAC put excessive weight on the Adams study is supported by what KSAC actually said.
Certainly. I mean, I think that the translation of the particular indicators of adverse findings come together in the weight of evidence approach that EPA used. They didn't look at particular studies in...
I do want you to focus on my question, which is, my question is whether EPA accurately described what KSAC did. That's the only thing I'm asking you about at this point, is whether its description of KSAC was accurate. That's all. And so I'd like you to focus on this aspect of it. They said that KSAC put heavy weight on the Adams study, and as I read the KSAC letters, it didn't. It just saw it as essentially one of many things it looked at. In fact, it saw it as a backup for the epidemiological evidence. Am I misreading it? Is the administrator accurate here that KSAC actually relied heavily on
If I may, I promise I will get to that question.
Okay, fine.
If
get
I may,
to it any way you like.
I would, I think, like to go back and address a little bit this idea that if the administrator, didn't accurately describe KSAC's, in this case, letters containing its recommendation, that that would somehow be a flaw in his reasoning.
Well, I thought you agreed with me at the beginning that it would be.
I would like to, I guess, amend that a little bit, just to say that I think really the question we get back to here is, did the administrator provide a reasoned explanation for the standard he set and for his departure from KSAC?
Well, wait, let's pursue that. I mean, suppose, take a hypothetical. Suppose KSAC says the standard should be set at 10. And in the agency's decision, it says the agency said it should be set at 20, and we think that's too high. You would agree that would be irrational, right? State accurately what KSAC says in order to be able to explain its departure from KSAC, right?
I mean, I think that would be irrational to describe KSAC's recommendation that way. But I guess I want to call the court's attention to the fact that these are not the same as the proposal and final with hundreds of pages of careful laying out of a reasoned decision. And I do think that it's the problem with sort of the test you're describing is that it could, without KSAC preparing basically the equivalent of something of what the administrator does, it could be quite easy for the administrator to get something a little bit off in trying to, I guess, read the minds of the KSAC panel of exactly what they were thinking.
I don't think these two we talked about required much mind reading. I'm just reading from the letter.
I think in terms of the exact weight that they gave each component of the body of evidence, I do think that the administrator was making an honest effort to determine what he thought the bases of KSAC's recommendation were, and to explain as part of his overall explanation of why he set the standard where he did, why he felt that he assessed the evidence differently than KSAC. I think that explanation is here. And I think that it makes sense. It's reasonable. Adams is clearly a key component of both KSAC's recommendation and state and environmental petitioners' arguments here. They essentially say that it controlled what the administrator could do, that he could not possibly set a standard above 0.070 because of Adams in combination with the epidemiological and other evidence. And the administrator said, I place different weight on Adams. That affects your assessment of the entire weight of evidence because of the key role that Adams plays.
I mean, if KSAC had relied on Adams as heavily as the administrator said, wouldn't KSAC have set it at 0.06?
I think maybe something that's useful here is to go back to the 1997 standard, as low that I am to compare.
I don't think you want to do that.
what I will say is that, there was one of the changes from 1997 was Adams. There was, I will certainly concede, although it was a lesser body of epidemiological evidence in 1997, there was some epidemiological evidence going down to the levels that we're talking about in 97. That itself did not do it.
I thought we said in ATA that there was no evidence below 0.08. Didn't we say that?
I will call on my EPA colleagues to correct me if I am getting this wrong. But I believe the studies did go into ranges below 0.080.
Yeah, you're probably right about that.
I think that, again, I'm sort of trying to...
Let me try it this way, Ms. Fleischer. Let me just try this. Because, I've been these critical questions, but there are aspects of what EPA did here that seems to me to illustrate how it should deal with KSAC. Take, for example, the Adams study, right? Adams reached a set of conclusions that EPA didn't agree with. EPA reassessed them, right? EPA staff.
Looked
at it differently, and it engaged KSAC in the process, and the KSAC members agreed with that approach. So there you have an example of exactly what I think Congress had in mind. I'm going back to Judge Griffith's very first question here, which is that, you know, here you have the agency rationally engaging CASAC in a reassessment of the science underlying CASAC's decision, and CASAC agreed with it. And I don't see that with this range. What I'm saying to you is I don't see it. I don't see that kind of a rational explanation when it comes to the fundamental range that CASAC reported and said rested on overwhelming scientific evidence. And that's why I was asking you those questions. I was looking for an explanation for that looked like the way in which they had handled atoms.
Certainly. I mean, right. I think the best explanation I can give you with regards to EPA's description of CASAC's reasoning is it's a summary. It is trying to capture the basis for reasoning that's laid out in a few, you know, 5 or 10 page letters. It's possible it's not exactly what CASAC had in their heads, but I think that here it was a reasonable discussion of what CASAC recommended.
Okay. Let me ask you, I'm sorry, you go ahead.
Can we go back just for a moment to just how this works? Because I'm trying to figure out what the task is here. Mr. Myers, I think, said the point of this exercise is to set a level that's protective of the at-risk population. The administrator here, if I understand, looked at this point 080 as a level that is protective of the healthy population, correct?
Correct.
Okay. So what really is the focus of what the administrator is trying to do here? Because it makes a difference then when you talk about the margin of error or the margin of safety, where you would set that level.
Certainly. I think that the administrator was very clear about the steps he was taking. He, you know, having described and assessed the evidence, he determined where he placed a high degree of certainty on evidence of adverse effects. And as you observed, that was 0.080 based on multiple strands of the evidence. He then looked at the increasing level of uncertainty below 0.080 and the evidence there. I would like to get back to this at some point as to his explanation of where he found uncertainty. But just to answer your question first, having done that, he balanced the uncertainties against his obligation to both protect at-risk groups and to provide a margin of safety.
Does he explain how he comes up with the margin of safety at all?
I think that he accounts for uncertain effects, and he discusses uncertainty throughout this rulemaking. And since the margin, he clearly describes in proceeding with the rulemaking that that's what the margin of safety is about. I think to ask for some magic words saying this is margin of safety here is just sort of unnecessary when he's doing what he's supposed to do. He specifically said in setting, in focusing on a 0.070 level of exposure to protect against, that was a level where there was some evidence of adverse effects in at-risk groups, that being asthmatics. And that's based on the fact that you have very certain evidence at 0.080, you have some strong clinical evidence that asthmatics will suffer effects at lower levels. That tells you should go below 0.080. And then you have very limited evidence other than that. Yet the administrator still went appreciably below 0.080 into the realm of those uncertain effects to both protect asthmatics and to provide that margin of safety. And it's, you know, certainly it's a fairly massive decision-making process. And so the margin of safety aspect gets intertwined with the rest of it, which is an approach that this
court... It's not like they come up with a range and then say, and then we're going to plus one for margin of safety. It doesn't work that way.
Certainly the administrator can do that if he wants to, but this court has been very clear that he does not have to. And I don't, you know, to recreate that requirement here, in miniature by saying you have to do this and then say at this step you're adding the margin of safety and at this step you're adding the margin of safety, I think would go against that precedent. If I could, I would like to finally get to what the administrator's explanation was regarding Adams and the epidemiological evidence. Mm-hmm. I think it would be hard to say here that there's no uncertainty at 0.060. Again, KSAC's recommendation, the staff paper supported a range above 0.060. There is uncertainty at that level. And so it becomes a question of how far below the certain evidence do you go towards 0.060 in order to set a requisite level? And the administrator explained that a single study, unconfirmed, could not get him all the way down to 0.060 and did not get him down as far as KSAC did.
Well, KSAC didn't recommend 0.060.
I just meant that it did. Oh. He still was above the top of KSAC's range. Uh-huh. But it was based on his uncertainty about Adams that everyone concedes there is some uncertainty.
But what about all the other evidence? What about all the epidemiological evidence?
Certainly. As to the epidemiological uh-huh. evidence, the key there is that the administrator's focus on the epidemiological evidence was that it showed even if you met the 1997 standard, uh-huh. you were still having adverse effects. There was quite consistent, coherent evidence to that respect, or with respect to that. When you get into, does the epidemiological evidence tell you a particular level at which those effects occur? It doesn't. The way it works is the epidemiological studies show you that ozone is significantly associated with adverse effects across a range of levels. And the administrator described that at the lower end of that range, you get into realms where there's uncertainty based on things like the effects of copollutants or the possibility of a threshold level. And so the epidemiological evidence doesn't get you there. And that's when you get to biological plausibility, which is a key aspect of do these associations make sense based on what we know about clinical and toxicological evidence as to how ozone affects human beings or animals. And in this case, because he placed little weight on Adams, the administrator said that at that level could not find the biological plausibility to again, get you down that far to 0.060. He did place a lot of weight on the evidence of greater sensitivity in asthmatics, but as I've described, that gets you somewhere below 0.080, but it doesn't tell you exactly where. And given those uncertainties, the administrator described that he viewed the bulk of the evidence as being at 0.080 and therefore protecting against exposures at 0.070 through a 0.075 standard would provide requisite protection with an adequate margin of safety.
I'm sorry, how does 0.075 protect 0.070?
Certainly, I think this is easy to lose in all the details. Basically, when you set a 0.075 standard, it's not just that states in complying it stop going above 0.075 but keep all their other days the same. You get a reduction across the board, across the entire range of days. So even your 8-hour periods with levels below 0.075 will still be reduced.
But a margin of safety sounds like a margin of safety is something that you should set it sufficiently low to provide a margin of safety, not sufficiently high to incorporate, and you might capture a lower level because of that margin. Do you see my point? That's what
I'm
a margin of safety.
Sure, I do.
Well, I mean, what you seem to be saying to me is that the margin of safety is that people levels will not necessarily be just at 0.075, right? They could well within this drop to 0.07, correct? Isn't that your point? Did I misunderstand your answer to Judge Griffith?
Just to restate to make sure we're saying the same thing, when you set a standard at 0.075, you have levels below that the result is levels below that as well.
My point is that if the science says it should be no greater than 0.07, then shouldn't the margin of safety be set to protect that? In other words, you might, because of uncertainties, set it at 0.0675. That's what margin of safety means.
Yes, I see what you're getting at now, I think. And my response would be that the margin of safety was in there when the administrator chose to focus on 0.070. So you don't have to add another margin of safety. He felt that, as he described it, he placed some weight on exposures at 0.070 because he considered, even at that level, them to be uncertain. So that was his way of protecting against uncertain effects. Because again, the bulk of your evidence is 0.080. You're going below, appreciably below that in order to provide that margin. I think the last thing that I would like to address is the suggestion that the administrator, in giving Adams little weight, was somehow ignoring Adams, or in setting a standard at 0.075 was ignoring effects below that level. And that's just, again, not true. As I've said, the 0.075 standard protected, substantially reduced or eliminated exposures down to 0.070, and also, as the administrator noted, did give you a relatively substantial reduction in exposures at 0.060. He describes that in his discussion of the effects of a 0.070 versus a 0.075 standard. So you are getting protection at the 0.060 level by reducing the standard to 0.075. The administrator, that was not an accidental effect of the administrator's decision. He was giving Adams some weight. And you know, as I've said, also a little weight as to biological plausibility in our briefs. But fundamentally, the administrator felt that the bulk of the evidence here was at 0.80 and below. There was uncertainty below that level. The administrator weighed the uncertainties differently than CASAC, but he still did provide a margin of safety. He did still protect at-risk groups. And in doing so, he satisfied the statutory standard of setting a requisite standard with an adequate margin of safety. Okay. I think I'm about to be out of time, but if any of you have any more questions, I'm happy to.
Thank you very much. You've been standing there a long time. Does Mr. Brownell and Mr. Brownell, they had some time left, right? Am I wrong? Okay. Mr. Brownell and Mr. Brownell, you can each take 2 minutes if you would like.
Thank you, Your Honor. I just have a few brief points. First, general references to certainty and uncertainty are not a basis for standard revision. I think there's general agreement on that. Also, more studies do not necessarily mean more risk. As EPA says at page 10 of their brief, in determining the level of the 1997 primary standard, EPA considered the latest scientific knowledge, including clinical studies providing clear evidence of adverse effects at concentrations as low as 0.080 ppm. We're dealing with basically the same information on adverse effects in both studies. There were small transient reversible effects down to 0.80, and below that, it was epidemiological evidence and other things which EPA has recognized is not evidence of a causal relationship. And in fact, they say that most of the positive associations were for studies that occurred in areas that likely did not meet even the current 0.08 standard. This is a decision in which risk assessment is important. As CASAC said, risk assessment must play a central role here because we are talking about risks below the 0.08 ppm level, which one can have different judgments as to. In assessing those risks, EPA said when we set the 1997 standard, risk assessment, risk estimates played an important role. Under the Whitman standard, requisite but not more than necessary, that recognizes that there's a lower as well as upper bound to the agency's standard setting authority, and what the agency determined was the lower bound, not more than necessary from a risk assessment standpoint in 1997 is an important starting point for consideration of standard revision under Whitman and as a matter of reasoned decision making. Thank you.
I'd like to address briefly, Your Honor, the last point Ms. Fleischer made about how the claiming that the 0.075 standard would largely eliminate harms at 0.070 and below. That's just not true. The risk assessment and exposure assessment shows that at a standard of 0.075, there would still be 770,000 children exposed to ozone levels of 0.070 or above in the just those cities study. That's at JA 1086. And at 4.4 million children would be exposed to ozone levels of 0.070 or more. At a standard of 0.075, 4.4 million kids would still be exposed to ozone levels of 0.060 or above. So it's just not true that a 0.075 standard eliminates exposures of concern at those lower levels. I wanted to go back to Judge Griffith's question about KSAC's, the importance of KSAC's recommendation. And one thing I didn't get to is how important it is in weighing whether the margin of safety has been adequately addressed. Because as the court mentioned, margin of safety is supposed to address, required to address harms that are uncertain or even unknown to science yet. And the harms that KSAC was recognizing here that EPA claims are less certain are at the very least entitled to protection by a margin of safety, because they are not, you know, wild, far-out harms when you have all of these eminent scientists realizing or saying that they require protection under the standard. I guess my time is up.
Anything else? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
So let's see. On the primary, that was the primary. On the secondary NAC, correct, we will hear from Mr. Meyer, right, for petitioner and, yeah. You want to take a break? Oh, sure. We're going to take a quick break. Okay. Yeah.
Thank you.
Mr. Meyer, I owe you an apology. Yeah.
Everybody left.
Oh. You want to get them? Yeah.
Everybody took advantage of a brief break. I think they all needed to go. So the whole council table.
If they're all gone?
Yes, they're all gone.
Well, let's go and help them. What do you think, Tom? Let's just go and help them. Yeah.
Is the clock running?
You need a longer break. Let me know when he shows up, would you?
Okay.
Sorry for the delay, Your Honor.
That's okay, Mr. Meyer. I guess we need, like KSAC, we need to define our terms more. Brief meant brief, right? And also, I owe you an apology. I cut off your rebuttal. So why don't you take, if you would like, 2 minutes of your rebuttal and then your 10 minutes of...
Well, I appreciate that, Judge, but actually, I had not reserved rebuttal time. Okay. Mr. Barron did rebuttal on both of us, but thank you very much.
All right, go ahead.
With respect to the secondary standards, the administrator was required here under the Clean Air Act to adopt a separate secondary standard because the record shows that a one-size-fits-all approach does not adequately protect public welfare from ozone pollution. As EPA staff and KSAC concluded, minimizing the number of peak ozone days, which an 8-hour standard is designed to do, does not adequately account for the cumulative exposure that plants and trees suffer over the course of an ozone season. For three reasons, the administrator's decision to nonetheless adopt an 8-hour standard was unlawful. First, that decision was unlawful in light of this court's ruling in American Farm Bureau. Now, EPA's decision here came out a year before the court's ruling in American Farm Bureau and therefore didn't have the benefit of the court's ruling on the secondary standard issues. As there, the administrator failed to identify a target level of welfare protection. He just said that a 0.75 8-hour standard would offer more protection than the previous 8-hour standard without relating that to any of the welfare effects that EPA looked at here, be it visible leaf injury, substantial biomass loss in trees, or crop loss. Next, as an American Farm Bureau, he also relied upon a flawed comparison of the air quality standards in justifying his decision. Now, we identify several problems with that comparison in our brief. One of the most important was that he arbitrarily focused on a level of 21 part per million hours, which was the least protective in the range of the cumulative standards under consideration. Now, staff identified that level as something that was worthy to consider with respect to crop loss, not with respect to some of the other welfare effects, such as preventing visible injury to leaves and also preventing biomass loss in trees, which staff concluded, and the EPA administrator did not disagree, should be the focus of the secondary standards here, not on preventing crop loss. KSAC identified a standard below, or at least a range below 21 part per million, unanimously. They identified that a level between 7 and 15 was the requisite level. That was also a level that was supported by the National Park Service, National Academy of Sciences, and EPA staff identified that as an appropriate level to focus on biomass loss in trees and visible leaf damage. But the administrator when he did this comparison, chose to focus only on the 21 part per million hour standard, despite the fact staff had done an analysis based on the level of protection or the welfare benefits that a 13 part per million hour standard would achieve. That was an arbitrary decision to do that. My second point, the 0.075 part per million 8-hour standard leaves many areas of the country inadequately protected against damage to plants and trees, despite the fact the statute requires protection against any anticipated adverse effects. For example, with respect to visible leaf damage, staff concluded based on analysis of air quality from 2001 to 2004 that even after meeting the 0.075 8-hour standard, visible leaf injury would still occur in many areas, and that included areas such as national parks and wilderness areas, state parks, places where people go to have the aesthetic enjoyment of viewing trees and plants. In 2004, the most recent of those years EPA looked at, they documented visible leaf injury in 30% of the counties that would have met a 0.075 part per million 8-hour standard. Regarding a second welfare effect, the biomass loss in seedlings and mature trees, EPA documented significant biomass loss in cottonwood trees in rural areas downwind of New York City where the level was below 0.075 part per million. Now, the administrator did not disagree that these harms were likely. He just said that the number and size of such areas and degree of risk were difficult to determine. But even if that were the case, it would not fulfill his statutory duty to set the secondary standard that protects against any anticipated adverse effects. In the light of staff's findings that I just described, there were significant anticipated adverse effects here if the 8-hour standard of 7.75 was chosen. Third, EPA's contention in its brief that uncertainties in the scientific evidence justified rejecting a separate secondary standard is unfounded. In fact, that position was rejected by EPA staff, CASAC, and even the administrator himself just days before he signed the final rule. EPA staff concluded that it was no longer appropriate to use an 8-hour standard to protect public welfare. Staff cited new field studies that reduced key uncertainties present in the last review when Administrator Browner decided not to adopt a separate secondary standard. Staff also cited two advances in computer modeling to help us determine whether ozone will harm plants and trees. Now, EPA fails to contest these points at all in its brief. With respect to CASAC, in the last NAAQS ozone rulemaking, they could not come to an agreement on either the form or the level of a separate secondary standard. Yet here, in this rulemaking, CASAC was unanimous that there was a clear need for a cumulative standard to protect public welfare. In fact, the preamble to the final rule refers to a memo that the deputy administrator sent to OMB just 5 days before the rule was signed, making it clear it was the administrator's position at that time that a cumulative standard was necessary to protect public welfare, and that ozone effects on vegetation are not appropriately characterized by the use of an 8-hour standard. So that uncertainties argument is unfounded. In conclusion, the 8-hour standard fails to protect public welfare against any anticipated adverse effects and is unsupported by the record. The court should therefore remand that standard as well as the primary standard to EPA with directions to expeditiously revise those standards in compliance with the statute.
Thank you.
I'll reserve the rest of my time. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Kaplan.
Good morning, Your Honors. David Kaplan with the Department of Justice. Before I begin speaking to issues that pertain specifically to the secondary standard, I want to clear up one issue regarding the role of CASAC and the kinds of advice it gives to EPA as required by the statute. Whenever CASAC provides EPA with advice, whether it be in the primary or secondary, it often does it on both science and on level, or I should say on a NAAQS standard itself. When CASAC provides, whenever you're setting a standard, and the actual standard, that necessarily involves policy judgments. Determining what is requisite given the actual raw data, the science, policy judgments are made. CASAC's recommendations, whether it be a range or a specific number for the actual standard, necessarily does involve policy judgments. It's appropriate. That's what CASAC does, and that's what EPA needs to tease out as it examines the CASAC. But it's not, CASAC is not just basing its recommendations on just pure raw science.
Well, why did it say then that its recommendation was supported by, quote, overwhelming scientific evidence?
Right. We have a sentence, a general sentence with that, and you have to ask, what do they mean by overwhelming support by science? If you start looking at science, you have to decide, well, what exactly are they referring to? If it's a chamber study, are they referring to just a particular decrement at a level, or are they talking about adversity determinations at that particular effect? And once you start talking about adversity determinations, you're talking about judgment. You're talking about policy. Are you talking about whether or not there's uncertainty associated with those judgments? So all I will say is you're reading too much into that particular sentence. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
To CASAC, there was no uncertainty. No uncertainty above 0.070.
Pardon me?
There was no uncertainty above 0.070 in CASAC's view,
in
right?
In CASAC's view, there was judgment as to what was requisite and science to support its judgments as to what was requisite. And it believed that together the range should be, for the actual standard, should be between 0.06 and 0.07 on the primary. The reason I stress this is that it's important just to understand in general that CASAC does make policy judgments necessarily because by definition when you're setting a standard or recommending a standard, you have to be making judgments. All the case law recognizes that it's not a pure question of just a scientific study alone. You need to make adversity determinations. You need to balance competing types of evidence. And so that is inherent in that CASAC decision, and if you were to tease the one sentence and put it in context, there'd be there'd be volumes written about what that one sentence means, and I'm pretty certain there'd be judgment elements associated with that.
Is this true also of CASAC's recommendation on the secondary that it should be a seasonal standard?
And so that is something that EPA took. Disagreed with that the standard.
It didn't disagree with it. It said EPA agrees that a cumulative seasonal standard is the most biologically relevant. But then it waived the uncertainty wand again.
No. Let me explain. But first, you are correct. Right. EPA did agree that the seasonal cumulative form is a better match in terms of associating exposure with growth rates. However, that doesn't end the story. That is a premise to begin with, but that doesn't end the story. EPA, in determining what would be an appropriate standard, necessarily had to exercise judgment, and to do so, it took that fact, the fact of the different forms under competing, and put them in the context of actual levels, and then did an analysis to see, well, when you put the form in context, the different forms in context of levels, what different levels, kinds of protection are we going to get? Will it be the same? Will there be different risks and uncertainties? Let me talk about the actual process EPA did here. EPA did identify a target level of protection. I think that's unmistakably clear. They did not use magic words. They didn't say, and attention everybody, here is the target level protection, but they identified 21 part per million hours as the target level. So that part is clear, and it's in the record, and we point to the citations where the agency does that. Secondly, the counsel today for the state said that, well, the agency did identified a target level, or identified 21, kind of conceding that it was a target level, but did so arbitrarily. And what they'd done in their reply brief is said, well, the agency based that on crop loss, 21 on crop loss.
I thought they were saying that this was a Farm Bureau problem.
Didn't
they say this was a Farm Bureau problem? That's
right.
That the agency didn't say what the requisite level was. It just compared it to the 0.075 Now, I can say that at the upper level it's the same, but it didn't make the underlying judgment that American Farm Bureau requires.
The Farm Bureau said that you need to identify a target level when you're doing these kinds of comparisons.
Right.
And the agency did identify a target level.
The target level
is 21 part per million hours. And I think that the state tacitly conceded it because then they went to criticize the reason EPA focused on 21. So we know that 21 is the target level EPA relied on. And I'd like to address their criticism of why EPA selected 21, because it's completely false.
What's false?
Okay, what's false about it is
I wasn't challenging you. I was asking you what statement do you say is false?
They said today and in their reply brief that EPA's 21 target level was based upon crop loss. This is important. It was based upon crop loss. And that's their primary argument for why 20 was inappropriate. That is not the case. EPA, in the record, identified crop loss as a concern, but concluded that crop loss was not, given the high uncertainties, it's such a managed resource, there are confounding factors, it's not something they can rely on primarily. EPA did a separate, independent analysis on biomass loss, and we've cited in the record where EPA did that. Let me give you the cites. Well, 73 Federal Register 16487, column 3. In the preamble, 72 Federal Register 37891, column 3. There, EPA identified biomass loss. It identified 10% loss of biomass for 50% of the tree seedlings studied in their analysis. And they did separate field studies. They did an exposure, a response curve for based upon their study of trees and forests. So EPA did not commit the primary flaw that the state has identified today, that is reliance on crop loss. That's simply incorrect. Likewise, they criticized EPA's reliance on 21 as the target level, claiming that EPA used that to set a standard at a level at which there'll be visible leaf injury. And they say that the staff, and then they quote, staff paper identifying the fact that visual leaf injury will remain, but they've told only half the story. The other half of the story is that the staff also said that it can't identify a level of foliar injury that is adverse because of too many confounding factors. How much rain occurs in a given season? There's too many confounding factors, and so EPA realized that there's significant uncertainty in determining what's adverse, and so EPA, when the state said that the level that was set is going to leave leaf effects, the issue really should be, are there adverse leaf effects? And EPA concluded there's no particular level we can identify in terms of adversity for leaf effects. And that's at 73 Federal Register, 16490, column 2. So that's a second significant error they've made in the criticism of the target level that EPA did select. Now, EPA also evaluated the degree of overlap in protection between using an 8-hour form and using a form under the cumulative standard, and found at the 0.075 level for 8-hour and at the 21 target level, there was great overlap, i.e., if you're complying with the 0.075, there are no areas in which there are no counties in which there's going to be a violation of the cumulative standard. And it concluded on that basis that there would be no additional protection afforded by using the cumulative form. Now, they raised this issue in the record in their reply, and we didn't cite it in our brief, but there's a memo setting out a table in which EPA did this analysis that shows that there is, in fact, no counties that would also violate the cumulative form at 0.075 compliance. And so the EPA had a robust analysis of this overlap and found that it was a proper basis to find adequate protection. Your Honor.
So you've been promised that you're the guy who's going to talk to us about remedy. Okay, hypothetically, if we thought there was a problem here, what does the agency have to say about the remedy here?
Well, I think that if there is a remand, yeah. Your Honor, there should not be a schedule set by this court. That is extraordinary relief. And the facts here don't warrant it. It's a rare circumstance where the court reaches out to do it. And here the facts don't warrant it. The agency should be free to exercise its discretion in terms of how it should use its resources and set its priorities.
But there's been a lot of delay in this particular
report. In this case, the kind of delay that there was the delay between the filing of their petition for review in this court and getting to this day here for argument.
But wasn't the issuance of the NAC itself late?
The issuance of the NAC was subject to a district court consent decree.
But it was late. Not in violation of the court order, but it was, in fact, four or five years beyond the statutory deadline?
It was late, but it was entered into an agreed consent decree with, I believe, the environmental groups.
That doesn't mean it wasn't late under the statute. I mean, it just meant the agency obeyed the order to correct the delay in issuing the NAC, right?
It was a schedule that everybody agreed was appropriate.
No, but aren't I right about that? It doesn't erase the fact that this NAC was issued under a court order many years late, right?
It was in compliance with the order, but yes, you're right. Okay. It was late in terms of just the 5 year, but maybe for good reason.
That's the standard that Congress imposed.
And Your Honor, and that's why the district court is the appropriate forum if there is going to be a schedule for the next review.
No, I wasn't asking you about the next review. I totally agree with you about that. Mm-hmm. We don't have any jurisdiction over the next review, but we do have jurisdiction over this one.
Well,
correct?
You do, but Your Honor, it wouldn't be appropriate here to reach out. There has been no violation of order, of an order, as there was in the EDF case that the state relies upon.
That's true.
And what's more, EPA should have the discretion to consider what comes back from this court's decision. It has to go back to perhaps the CASAC and work with CASAC. It has to potentially go out for notice and comment. It has to also consider how to work any remand here in conjunction with its ongoing review. And keep in mind that ongoing review is going to be looking at new science, new evidence.
When will
new
the agency
comments.
Issue the new NAC?
Well, you're talking about the periodic review?
Yeah.
Yeah. The agency previously represented this court that it would have the final done by July of 2014.
Well, what about requiring the agency to finish this by then?
But we
and
know
that leaves the agency the flexibility. And again, I'm just speaking hypothetically.
Right.
But that leaves the agency free to consolidate the two of them. As I can't remember. I think it was Mr. Barron. Or maybe Mr. Meyer suggested that as a possibility.
It may well be, but the agency knows that 20 July 2014 date has slipped. And it's slipped because, in large part, comments they've received from CASAC. And so it's going to be longer than July 2014. It's not appropriate for this. So you said that it may well be appropriate for EPA to combine any remand with any periodic review. And that may well be right. But this court is not properly situated to understand and make a judgment as to what would be an appropriate schedule.
I wasn't suggesting that we would direct that. I was just suggesting that if we gave the agency until the day, till what it's told us it's going to do the next NAC and to do this one, that leaves the agency free to decide how to proceed.
Well, it's true, but the schedule right now is in flux. As I've said,
that's the problem, right?
Well, it's a problem that can be appropriately remedied by the district court.
You're missing my point. The district court has no role in this proceeding, right? If there's a remand, it's a remand pursuant to the direction of this court. We don't need the district court doesn't play any role in that.
I agree with that point, Your Honor, but I think the assumption that you and I are both making in this discussion is that it's likely for the agency to address any remand in conjunction with the periodic review. It doesn't have to be that way, but it's likely, and so it would be very disruptive to put the agency on parallel, different tracks, a remand on one record while it's in the middle of an ongoing periodic review looking at new science, and so we have
to. So, under your theory, is it possible that under your idea, is it possible that if we just remand it, the agency could, you know, issue the new NAC in 2014 and then this one sometime after that? Well, I mean, how would that work?
I don't think that's likely at all, Your Honor.
That would make no sense.
Exactly.
Not likely.
It's not likely. It wouldn't make sense.
So then what's the problem directing the agency to get this done
before
it does the 2014 NAC, and it could put them together if it wants?
Because right now there are too many unknowns to judge what the appropriate schedule would be. Right now, as I've said, the July 2014 date we know is going to be slipped.
All right. Hey, do you have any questions for Randy?
I have.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. Mr. Kaplan, just a point of clarification. You said at one point that the agency had identified 21 parts per million as the target level. What's the difference between identifying that as the target level and setting that as the standard?
Well, it identified as the target level of protection, but it also wanted to do a comparison between that form and the form under using the 8-hour form. The target level protection is different from actually making the requisite determination. It's a step in the analytic reasoning when you're doing comparisons.
So when did the EPA make the finding of what the requisite level is? They didn't.
They
talked about this target level.
They most certainly did.
Where? Give me the.
Where did they actually make?
Yes. Where they
words?
Actually
say the magic
it?
Words?
Where can I? Well, I wouldn't call them magic words. They're what the statute requires.
Right. Well, they're magic for that reason, for sure. But the agency most certainly did make the judgment on column 2 on page 16,500. After doing all the analysis, doing the comparison.
Joint Appendix 167, is that right?
I don't have the JA.
Well, that's what I have.
Yes.
Thank you.
And so if you look right above D, there's a paragraph. The last sentence says, this judgment of the administrator appropriately considers the requirement for a standard that is neither more nor less stringent than necessary for this purpose. That, by definition, is the requisite finding. That's the definition of requisite. And that's the summary paragraph after setting out the rationale of talking about using the target level, making the comparison, seeing great degree of overlap, seeing no additional benefit if we were to use the cumulative form, and seeing the risk of overprotection if you use the cumulative form. So it's all there in the analysis. And I know that they said that in their brief, that EPA didn't even say the words, but that was just false, Your Honor. Your Honor, if you have no further
thank
questions.
You.
Thank you.
Mr. Meyer had a minute or two. Oh, you have 3 minutes.
Wow. Could you address the point that I just raised with opposing counsel about whether there was a requisite finding on vegetation?
Yes, Your Honor. No, there was not a requisite finding on vegetation. Mr. Kaplan just read you some boilerplate language, but they didn't adopt, they never explained how this 0.075.
How would you describe the paragraphs that precede that? What's going on there when they're talking about 21 parts per million?
Well, they are talking about I think the term they use is the administrator focused his consideration on a cumulative standard of 21 part per million hours. So that is saying that is where they looked initially to see whether or not welfare was adequately protected under the Act. As I explained previously, the use of that level was an arbitrary one. But my second point, which I think may go more to what you were saying, Judge Griffith, was that it didn't explain how the 0.075 8-hour standard that they adopted is requisite to protect public welfare. They just said that that would provide protection over the previous 8-hour standard. There's nothing in the record in terms of preventing visible leaf injury or biomass loss that they tie to that 0.075 8-hour standard. I'd like to make two other quick points on the vegetation before turning quickly back to remedy. First, staff, contrary to what Mr. Kaplan said, staff concluded that visible foliar injury, especially in national parks and wilderness areas, can be reasonably considered to be an adverse effect to public welfare. That's at page 157 of the Joint Appendix. In addition, Mr. Kaplan tries to make the argument that this 21 ppm standard is relevant to preventing biomass loss in trees, yet the studies that he cites to were studies from the last NAAQS review. EPA staff relied upon studies in this NAAQS review when staff recommended that a level in the area of 7 to 13 was the appropriate level to protect public welfare, specifically trees. And we cite to that on page 14 of our reply brief, footnote 3. Finally, with respect to remedy, what you've heard now from EPA counsel is that the date that they told this court they were going to meet with respect to the next ozone NAAQS, they're not going to meet it. And this is a repeated pattern in terms of failing to meet the NAAQS deadlines, as Judge Tatel pointed out. And why that's relevant here is that EPA has said that they would address any problems with this rule in the context of its next rulemaking. And now we're hearing that that may not occur until sometime late in 2014. Yet we're dealing with these problems in this case now, the fact that this standard inadequately protects public health and welfare. They're essentially saying, well, why don't you wait till the next NAAQS comes out? You can challenge it then. That frustrates the ability of the states, the environmental petitioners, to make sure that the requisite protections under the Clean Air Act with respect to both public health and public welfare are in place and in a timely manner. So therefore, we ask that the court remand the standards to EPA with a deadline for them to come out with a decision, which they can either expedite their current review or they can make a decision very quickly based on the record that's already before them.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Case, I think, is submitted, correct? Is there any more rebuttal? No. Case is submitted. Thank you.